You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. Join me as we uncover the rich histories of North America's Great Plains, exploring the latest archaeological discoveries and past cultures that shaped this storied region. Welcome to the podcast. Welcome to episode 25 of the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Carlton Shield Chief Gover. And I am thrilled to have you join me on this exciting journey through the rich and fascinating histories of North America's Great Plains. So for context for this episode, you know, episodes 20 through 24 are recorded back in May before I went to field school. I am now back. I'm recording this on July 31st, so a week before this is due. And so it's been like 2 months since I've recorded an episode. And I am gearing up for the upcoming semester, while also catching up on work at the museum. So I apologize for maybe the brevity of this episode. We will swing back into having more guests. And I would really like to know, for the listeners that I have, I'm not sure of the numbers yet, if you guys are liking the interview episodes or would like me to go back to the lecture style, just let me know. Drop me an email if you have my Instagram. Just let me know how I'm doing. It'd be greatly, greatly appreciated. Both my contact information, both Instagram and email, are at the bottom of the episode description. So just give me a heads up as to how I'm doing. But today, I felt this would be a good time to tackle the top five misconceptions about Great Plains archaeology. And we've talked a little about them in previous episodes, acknowledged their existence, maybe briefly went over them. But the five that I want to really talk about today, now that we've had 24 episodes, right? First being the plains were empty or underpopulated. Two, there was no diversity of cultures. Three, it's all about projectile points and bison jumps. Four, there's not much to see in comparison to the Southwest, Mesoamerica, or even the Southeast. And the fifth one is that it's all in the past. And so let's talk about the first misconception, right? The Great Plains were empty or underpopulated. Now, if we hearken back to the episodes about the woodlands and Plains Village period, we can already see that people have been present on the Great Plains and in large numbers, right? Predominantly along the river systems. And in archaeology, that really stems back to when we started understanding Great Plains populations to, you know, WPA era, you know, or CCC era archaeology in the 30s. But then a lot of the federal dam projects and reservoir projects in the 50s and 60s, you know, in the post-World War II era. And so part of what's playing to this misconception is that if we look at the Great Plains states, Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Nebraska, Eastern Colorado, South Dakota, North Dakota, Western Iowa, Western Minnesota, Eastern Montana, you know, most of Wyoming, and those Canadian provinces, particularly in the United States, with the exception for like Colorado, Montana, and Wyoming, the amount of public land present in those other U.S. states is generally like less than 5%. And so like Montana, 30% of the state is public. Wyoming, 48%. Colorado, 35%. But if we start looking at the states to the east, right? Oklahoma is 1.6, Nebraska is 1.1, Iowa is 0.3%, Kansas is like 1.9. that when you have states, especially in the Great Plains, that do not have large percentages of the land being public, those federal and state laws that apply to survey and protection of cultural resources, you know, don't apply as broadly as like Wyoming or Colorado, right? Where if you even look at the radiocarbon libraries of these states, like Wyoming has thousands of radiocarbon dates, whereas like Kansas has maybe like less than 2,000. That plays into site availability. There are a lot more sites and archaeological components in the Great Plains that professional archaeologists are largely unaware of because they exist on private property and no formal excavations have occurred, and a large portion of those assemblages are surface collected and owned by property owners. So there's a bit of bias going into what archaeologists and professionals within cultural heritage have access to. So it's hard to actually like realize what is the full scope of archaeological sites. Not to mention that these states in particular, like the Great Plains, it's predominantly dominated by negative topography. There's a lot of soil deposition, like it is a nutrient-rich area. And so many of the sites are buried, whereas in more arid regions to the west, where there's not as much soil turnover, that sites are readily available. So not only do we have a lack of public land, but also the site formation processes in the Great Plains cover up sites to make them harder to find. But we can look at already available sites that we know about, especially in the Missouri River Basin, especially in the looking at late woodland, Plains Village periods, where we're seeing large towns developing where there's thousands of people. So we can look at what's going on with the Central Plains tradition, initial Middle Missouri and extended Middle Missouri, initial coalescent. We can look at these archaeological components, particularly in Kansas, Nebraska, and South Dakota, which is my bias. This is where I work, where we're seeing large population centers. You know, we can look at a site that I worked at with my advisors, Dr. Douglas Manforth, Dr. Kristen Carlson, 25BD1 in Northeast Nebraska, like potentially 6,000 people were living at that site. And we can tell that by the amount of houses, these proto-earth lodges that existed. So we have a couple of different, you know, two primary reasons why we have this misconception. Right. So bias in public land availability and settlement processes that cover the record. And so we have these complex village sites. We have these massive bison procurement centers that indicate like large scale bison processing beyond just small scale nomadic groups. And we can see through time a deep indigenous presence and cultural continuity by at least like woodland all the way up until contact and beyond. And using this to springboard us into another misconception is that there was no diversity of cultures, right? Like when we think of Plains Indians, we really think of the horse nomads, Comanches, Lakotas, Comanches, Apaches, Arapahoes. But that's just not true. That not only do we have an incredible cultural and linguistic diversity across the plains, we have Siouan languages, we have Caddoan languages, Hutto-Aztecan languages. We do see, like, people forget, and that as we've discussed in this podcast, the Plains villagers, I hate that term, but, you know, the farmers of the Great Plains that have been here for a very long time. And even between, like, if we look at ancestral Mandans and Hidatsas versus ancestral Arikaras and Pawnees, ancestral Wichitas, that there's a lot going on, and there's different styles of houses being built and different engineering that's happening. So the difference between like rectangular hipped roof structures versus rectangular or square hipped roof structures, that there are different mechanisms for how people are not only constructing houses, but also the pottery is very different. And you really just have to get into the weeds of the cultural complexities of the Great Plains, that it wasn't just nomads, that for a very long time, we had such a huge breadth of farming communities that were practicing so many different cultural beliefs and industries that were directly connected into trade networks and trade systems with the Midwest and Southeast, right? Like looking at, again, the Missouri River being this highway into the eastern part of the United States. So we can look at the Leary site on the Kansas-Nebraska border, multi-component site, meaning there's a couple cultures that live there. But it was a known trade center that later would become what they call Mountain Man Rendezvous. And if you look at the distribution of Mountain Man Rendezvous, which were very famous in the 19th and 18th centuries, all those Mountain Man Rendezvous are actually co-opted indigenous trade centers. So we do have a lot of diversity, and that diversity is predominantly centered, you know, earlier in time, you know, prior to 1500s along the Missouri River drainage, so north to south, but their cultural landscapes go east to west, right? And then, of course, when you have the reintroduction of horses, that we see a breadth of new cultural practices being introduced, particularly in the western part of the Great Plains, where we see Comanches and Apaches coming down from the north. We have Lakotas and Cheyennes coming in from the Great Lakes, and even them, they have different cultural practices that they're it just requires you to take the time to learn them, which plays into a quick one that I want to hit, right? Great Plains archaeology is dominated by projectile points and bison jumps. Like projectile points are easy to find. Like my advisor, Dr. Bamforth, he came out to my field school this summer and was talking to students. And, you know, one thing he mentioned that really struck with me, that every arrowhead or atlatl point, stone knife, every lithic tool that has ever been made in the history of humankind is still around, right? Like they haven't disappeared. They haven't been destroyed, maybe reduced in some way, but like they're still present. And so, of course, there's already an artifact bias and distribution of those arrowheads, whereas like pottery can get ground up and some other forms of material culture can be lost. But like every arrowhead ever made, from the first to the worst, is still around in some way, shape, or form. And that, you know, real quick before we take this break, you know, using the farmers, the Missouri River farmers, as an example, there's pottery, there's other forms of cultural material that goes into these farming communities. And agriculture is a big part of it that's often overlooked. And so with that, we'll take our first break. All right, we're back. And so we want to just tackle the last two myths pretty quickly, or somewhat quickly, who knows, who can say. So the fourth one, the fourth misconception about Great Plains archaeology, there's not much to see compared to the southwestern Mesoamerica. Now, we already talked about the site biases, both in how the archaeological records form in the Great Plains compared to more arid environments. But also, the southwest of Mesoamerica are really famous for monumental architecture that's made out of stone. In the Great Plains, where you have so much soil and clay, you don't need to carve up stone blocks to make monumental architecture. And in the Great Plains, especially in the eastern part of the Great Plains, that was, you know, we have monumental architecture, but it's in the form of earthen mounds. And unfortunately, a lot of earthen mounds have been bulldozed away, like those pyramid mounds made out of earth have been removed. And so hearkening back to why not having a lot of public land is a problem, is that there you can see photographs in the 40s and 50s of like eastern Kansas, eastern Nebraska, where there's mound pyramid structures, but they're on private land and oftentimes they're just bulldozed away, like getting rid of by the farmers. Whereas in the southwest, where you don't have clay and dirt, you have to resort to masonry. So I'm not trying to dissuade how awesome the monumental architecture is in the southwest or Mesoamerica, but because it is made out of stone, allows it to be preserved much longer and much more difficult to destroy. Whereas in the Great Plains, our monumental architecture was made out of earth, like very similar to Cahokia or the other mound cultures in the Midwest. We had them too in the Great Plains, especially on the lower branch of the Missouri River. But for whatever reason, unlike in other parts of the, not unlike other parts of the United States where these mounds have been destroyed, there's plenty of those stories from the Ohio River Valley, the Mississippi River Valleys, and the Missouri River. I don't know what caused it, but like, especially around the Kansas City area, the Omaha, Lincoln areas, they're mostly bulldozed. So there's plenty to see, but also, again, reminding you, like, the archaeological record in the Great Plains is largely buried. The more west you go, right, that changes, and you can still see bison drive lanes and bison traps and a lot of features in architecture and modifications to the landscape that they use stone, right? Because the closer you get to the mountains, the less depositional processes change of the soil. Like, those are still visible. You can still see it, Rocky Mountain National Park. Not to mention the medicine wheels and some of the more ceremonial architecture that we talked about early on in this podcast, right? Talking about the archaic. That's still around. Like, there's still stuff going on, but I can't stress enough. It's we don't know what we don't know. And a lot of what we don't know is on private property where the record is buried under a lot in a floodplain somewhere, right? Or the Missouri River is known as a very meandering river. And even since the 1800s, some of the branches of the Missouri River have changed so much that sites have been washed away by the Missouri River itself. So there's a lot there, just it's underground or gone. But we can't rely on what we can see with the naked eye today driving along Interstate 80, Interstate 60, and be like, oh, well, there's just nothing here and that's all it's always been. It's like, no, things have changed. We're the Great Plains is gets a lot of weather. It's really vegetation dense. And then it's grasslands, right? So the Southwest Mesoamerica is super cool, but the environment, there's a little bit of environmental determinism in how people can like modified their landscape and helped contribute to cultural practices and how you build structures and how, and this sort of monumental architecture that you are able to construct. I hope this episode is of somewhat interest, right? But there's still mound sites. Like if you go to Oklahoma, Spiro Mounds still exists. I mean, it was dynamited. It's not in its original form in the slightest. But there's still places that you can go. There's still, you just have to look for them. I mean, hell, even Cahokia, you know, the largest pyramid complex north of Mesoamerica, doesn't get a lot of attention because it's also made out of earth and it's a state park, not a national park. Like there is a bias that's not just inherent to the Great Plains. And the last thing I want to touch on is it's all in the past, right? And what I mean by it's all in the past, that the archaeological record is still a living history for indigenous communities and American Indian nations today, right? Like there's still a real time, contemporary interest and engagement with the archaeological record, not only for federal compliance, but a lot of the nations that are from the Great Plains were removed from their homelands and put somewhere else. And so the archaeological record, that connection between those ancestral places with contemporary American Indian nations, is still ongoing. And as some of our TIPOs have talked about in the previous episodes, there is still that connection between them and the record, and that, you know, tribal strike preservation officers and ACPRA officers of tribes exert the sovereignty of their nations into states within America that they once had homelands. And so it's very much intertwined with NAGPRA Section 106 under the National Historic Preservation Act and heritage stewardship. That there's still active projects going on today. Like anytime there's a highway or road being built, National Historic Preservation Act, as of now, still kicks in, although we're really looking at the potential of the National Historic Preservation Act becoming an unfunded mandate by the federal government, meaning that it's still a law, but the federal government won't pay offices to help support and carry out the law, which might be good to have. I'll reach out to a couple state archaeologists, see if they want to get on the podcast to talk about it, if they're able to, who can say. And so, and you know, even some of the more, let me rephrase that. There's a lot of incredible work being done in the Great Plains by archaeologists. We all love talking about Waddle Wadle, who's passed away for a while now. He did really good work back in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, some quintessential stuff, but those methods they're different. And we've learned a lot more by building upon them. And you know, I can look at some of the stuff, some of the research on ancestral Pawnee sites and know that those interpretations made in the 30s and 40s were erroneous, and that because they were asking questions that weren't informed by, you know, necessarily indigenous oral traditions, perspectives, or histories, that not only their interpretations were incorrect, but even the kinds of questions they were asking weren't actually going to, like those research questions weren't going to actually provide holistic answers, or not even necessarily the correct answers. So, and this is stuff like these misconceptions are all things that I try to tackle a little bit in each episode, right? Like talking to folks why the Great Plains is awesome, or bringing up different parts of Great Plains archaeology, not necessarily addressing them head on, but just through the content itself, talking about the diversity of Great Plains archaeology. Like, this is an incredibly cool area. And as I have said, and other folks in this podcast have talked about, we need more plain people interested in plains archaeology. There's so much to do here. And even though these states, we have like less than 2% of the land being public, there's still plenty of work to be done, and many interested private landowners that want to engage with archaeologists, which can be hit or miss at times. Maybe I'll do an episode on some of my interactions with the public. But that being said, there's a lot to Great Plains archaeology. If there's topics you'd like me to cover, or guests you think I should interview, please send me an email or reach out to me on Instagram. I'd love to hear from the folks that are listening. I get a couple emails every now and then. Usually it's about Pawnee stuff, which is fine. But like in general, love to hear what you guys want to know, would like me to investigate. Just give me a heads up. Honestly, it helps. Like, it'd be fun for me to get some topics to cover. So with that, we're going to just end this podcast like 5 minutes early. I'm going to get back to interview a couple more folks in some of these other later episodes, but would love to hear from you guys about how the podcast is going, what you'd like to hear, what's working, what's not. And with that, I will see you guys next time. Thank you for listening to the Great Plains Archaeology Podcast. You can follow me on Instagram at Pawnee_archaeologist, and you can also email me at greatplainsarcpodcast@gmail.com. And remember, anybody can love the mountains, but it takes a soul to love the prairie. American author Willa Cather.
The Archaeology Podcast Network is 10 years old this year. Our executive producer is Ashley Airy, our social media coordinator is Matilda Siebrecht, and our chief editor is Rachel Roden. The Archaeology Podcast Network was co-founded by Chris Webster and Tristan Boyle in 2014 and is part of Cultural Media and DigTech LLC.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.